Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. George Grant joins us. He's a musician who teaches music to people of all stripe, whether you think you're a musician or not. Why? He says, well, making music can be a meditation. He takes as his inspiration devotional music of ancient cultures and uses that for improvisation, jazz, avant-garde, world music. And he joins us from Salt Lake City to tell us about this process, to tell us about how we can all make music as a process, not necessarily focused on the product, but just as a joyful, creative, meditative process. So George, we're all going to be asking you questions and commenting, but tell us a bit about what it is that you do.
Well, I happened to be at the right place at the right time one time in my life in Anchorage, Alaska, where I had been trained as a musician for many years, and then all of a sudden these groups of people started to approach me because they wanted to drum, and they didn't want to learn it in the traditional sense, which I think is to please an audience and to perform, quote, you know, for the audience is out there and you're up on the stage and it's a kind of a spectator sport. And all of a sudden these new people, these people kind of innately knew that they had to get away from the rat race of their life and all the technology. And this is about when the new age music and Windham Hill and some of these labels were being born. And I think there was this innate inner human knowing that we're going to have technology, but we've got to keep our humanity. And so I started teaching these group drumming improvisation sessions, and I was prepared to do it, and it just kind of happened. And then I discovered over a period of years that the voice is really the secret to all of this. We can learn to drum by saying sound syllables. I have a program I call Drum Talk, and this is a hybrid based on my study of world music, where you do chant traditional patterns with, in India they might say, da ding, dagi nagi tidri kitataka, you know, things like this. Another country, different rhythms, different patterns. And I've invented my own system for Americans, young kids to adults. It's really, really inspiring.
So the idea is to get everybody playing and to use the voice as a memory notation system for learning the beats of the drum or whatever instrument that you're playing, to playing music and drumming and dancing. In some cultures, one word covers all those bases because they're all performed together.
In Indian culture, in the Vedic culture, there's a word called Sangeet, and we would see it spelled as Sangeeta. And this is a Sanskrit word which combines instrumental music, vocal music, and dance all as one thing. And it's very interesting philosophically to not separate these things. I was talking with a University of Utah professor yesterday who teaches piano, and she's got people dancing the rumba to learn piano. And some people don't get this, but it's really obvious to her and her young students.
So music, really, you're trying to engage the whole brain in the process of playing music?
Absolutely. I think most modern educators even understand that music is an interesting activity. It uses all of the parts of the brain, at least that we can measure with current science, simultaneously. All these, like if you look at the eight centers of the brain, I believe it's called the Gardner model, music interacts all of them. If we're using vocal music, the speech center is also involved.
Okay.
But all the other centers, and this is the mystics and whatnot who talk about the seven bodies being physical, etheric, astral, upper mental, lower mental, Buddhic, things like this. the music can interpenetrate simultaneously all of these intuitive, physical, emotional, mental aspects of ourselves. And mm-hmm. this is unlike any other activity that we have.
Why is that, do you suppose? What's special about this, and why don't other animals make music other than vocalizations?
Well, I don't know.
Probably because they can't play any music.
Dolphin and whale stuff.
Yeah.
And wolves, if you've ever heard dogs, coyotes out there, who knows what they're thinking. There's some strange recordings of little insects and crickets and bees that on the nature channels we see this stuff. There is so much we don't know.
What about the bees in the hive? When they go out and they find a really good spot for honey, they come back and they dance and they do all that
Absolutely.
In order to
now,
use it as
musical?
A conveying of information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Patterns. Abstract patterns communicate meaning. And we may not know what that is with our logical brain. When I have a session of people come to my basement, and they may have never been there or know each other before, and we do a few little exercises to learn to loosen up and break the ice and then mm-hmm. train with each other on in terms of listening closely. Then okay. we say, okay, here goes nothing. Let's just tone. And we all know when to stop. Something is going on that we don't logically know about, but it is amazing, and it always happens. We all know when to stop.
So there's,
so there's something being communicated.
Communication happening in addition to, yeah. Okay, then we can better understand how, you know, flocks of geese can all turn on a dime or schools of fish or something, right?
Who knows?
They're entrained to each other in some way.
I have discovered that in my own experience as a vocalist, when I'm with a group of people, there is something that magic, some magic happens that you just can't do by yourself. There is that group process. And people constantly ask me, well, what are the benefits of vocal toning and the harmonic overtone chant and music meditation and improvisation? And I think one of the key benefits is this community development mm-hmm. That we think we may have, but do we really? In this high-tech, high-paced world, it's we're going 1,000 miles an hour, and just the chance to sit down with people and let yourself go into this completely safe, intuitive, nonverbal, we call it meditation, but it's recreation too, recreation.
Okay.
And this, when you talk about geese, it reminds me of when we get together in groups like this. It is a magic because we all know when to turn and go down and go up. It's really neat.
And create quite a symphony or a cacophony, depending on how you're listening.
Know what they're doing, that's for sure.
Okay, in terms of how to listen, you say that sounds have color and texture as well, if you're listening carefully. Is this part of the whole brain process of listening? Is this synesthesia, in a sense, where your senses crosswire?
I think if you go into a music studio with musicians, they sometimes talk about E-flat or F-sharp or something like that, but mostly they're talking visual or tactile terminology. They're talking mm-hmm. wet or dry or cool or warm or hollow or brittle or rough. Or it's very interesting in a sound studio with headphones on and the articulate sound coming into your ears. It becomes very visual.
Uh-huh.
And we learn to, I think the way to learn that is by comparing. If you take a bell and you take another bell, another cymbal, two metal sounds, and you play each of them once back and forth, and you ask people to say which one, by a show of hands, is brighter and which one is darker. Almost everybody
okay.
agrees
uh-huh.
as to what this is without me telling them.
Okay.
And this is part of this light, seeing the light in tone.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it so interesting that music and tones can convey so much emotion and that it correlates so beautifully with our sense of emotions and mood and those ambiance?
Well, this is why the devotional yogas, the devotional meditations, the heart-based, prayerful, spiritual and religious practices, almost all of them have music. To key that in, it's a natural mm-hmm. thing. It's not dogmatic. And I think if we just give ourselves that chance, the music turns off the left brain.
Mm-hmm.
If we'll just be kind of, these are just kind of general terms, but gets us into our whole brain. Music can do this better than just about anything I know of.
But if it's, you know, they say that musicians, children even, who learn to play music at an early age develop more corpus callosum than non-music playing children. So I would assume that's because the two hemispheres of the brain need to communicate more fully and more rapidly, right? So it's actually helping to enhance the structure of your brain. So rather than turning off the intellect of the left brain, doesn't it leave that on and yet turn on simultaneous, as you were pointing out earlier, the right brain, that this, all the parts of the brain. So maybe it's really helping to encourage the whole brain functioning, which is optimal
functioning.
The whole brain
is the key, I think, how the two hemispheres interrelate. And if we can find ways to do that, I think our society is becoming so left brain that we're going to start to walk sideways or lopsided if we don't figure out some ways to recognize that the arts is not some luxury. Uh-huh. It's brain training. And if you grow up making dance and music and painting, it's problem-solving, abstract thinking skills that later you can become a great computer scientist. Einstein attributed his theory of relativity and the discovery of that to his music.
Oh,
he directly
really? Tell us.
Stated that it was a musical intuition.
Tell us more about that. I hadn't heard that.
Well, I apparently, and I'm not a scientist, the arts is the only thing I can do and talk to people, but apparently he saw relativity.
Uh-huh.
He saw it when he was asked, people asked him about it. And then it took him a while to equate and do the math and the formulas. They didn't prove his theories until long after he was dead. Apparently they did it with some sort of light that was beaming, and they did it on Mount Washington, New Hampshire. These plates were picking up, and they could detect the light coming from the sun somehow. But I read a quote from him. It was a direct quote. I perceived my theory of relativity as a musical intuition. And he did play the violin, apparently, every day. And it was an informal, he just did it to kind of like people play tennis. He played the violin, you know?
Just to get those juices flowing, maybe.
Yeah, well, and there's a great book. I like it anyway. It's called Drawing on the Artist Within, or Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain by Betty Edwards.
Oh, yes.
And she talks about this relationship of the left brain and the right brain really well. It's bigger than, she's teaching you how to draw, but it's much more than that if you read it.
Uh-huh.
And she talks about how we have to have this period of saturation and information gathering, and then you let go. You go into this other kind of fertilization, incubation, I think is what she might call it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, there's this aha moment. And then you get to see all that information come to some new solution to your problem.
Yeah.
But by playing the violin or by playing tennis or going for a walk, you let your brain do that saturation. And even though we don't see ourselves consciously doing something, there is something going on inside of that processing. There's direct correlation. There is research, plenty of research that shows that young children who grow up with the beat, they don't even have to be taking music lessons. It's maybe they're dancing instead.
Right.
And they get the beat in their body. There is something that happens, and my music therapy friends call it being timed. And I heard a brain researcher from the University of Idaho give a lecture, and he talked about these boutons on the dendrites of the brain. It's like DNA, but different. And these are like little codes. And when you get that coding when you're like very, very young, it's going to be with you the rest of your life. If you are timed, you're going to have a much higher chance of being successful in academics and in just life, social skills. So, I mean, there's all the proof we need to just dance and get young children doing some sort of music. But the danger is that sometimes music is taught as this, you know, life or death boot camp. You've got to be the best. We're going to the Olympics. Yes, I know you're only 4 years old, but we're going to the Olympics next year. You know, and sometimes this, I find adults come to my workshops, and they take the something they really want to be there. They want to sing. They want to open up, but they're scared to death. And something happens where they get through it, and then later they tell me. They don't tell me at the beginning, but they often tell me in the middle or towards the end of the workshops, often while they're crying, that when they were in junior high, their choral teacher told them to just move their lips and not sing because their their tone was going to mess up the concert.
Oh, geez.
And this traumatizes teenagers in the seventh grade. That's like totally vulnerable time. Music, the voice, is one of the most vulnerable gateways in our human psyche and the emotions. And this is not arts education. There's got to be different ways. You have your number one choir and then your number two performing choir, and you just have different expectations perhaps. But let everybody into music, not making it so exclusive. And this is what I am kind of...
not killing the joy of it.
No. Absolutely. If we enjoy skiing, maybe we'll be better at it and can get to the Olympics that way, you know?
Well, also, what you're pointing out is we're now discovering that it's an important brain development tool, making music, dancing, getting the beat inside of us. I mean, we know, you know, people doing cross-crawl exercises, it's been demonstrated, help brain-injured people to relay down some of the lost neurological pathways of their brain. I talked to a gentleman recently who had a stroke, and he said that he taught himself to read again by reading out loud. He didn't care what he sounded like. He couldn't speak. So he would just force himself to read out loud to himself. And he said it was because I got my mouth and my brain moving that I was able to regain speech. You wouldn't know that he'd ever had a stroke before and had lost that ability. So we're now finding that the brain is very active and malleable, even into old age. So
yeah, I think they're doing things with Alzheimer's, too.
Yeah, we need
rhythm to... Rhythm helps to slow down the degeneration.
So we're just discovering exactly what activates our brain. So maybe we can go back to the educational system now and rethink, what's the purpose here? Is it to produce a nice little choir to sing for the parents, or is it to help those children integrate and develop new neurological pathways and new joy in learning?
Absolutely. Instead of product a little bit.
And as you're finding out, even the adults can go in there and relearn and get those switches flicked on too, right?
Absolutely. It's never too late. And everybody has something to feel and something to express. And, you know, I can come home from teaching drums to young children, and which is pretty loud and pretty crazy and pretty high pace. And I come home and I'm like beat. I'm tired. And some of my friends might come over. We might have a little class, and I'll just do the toning. And I feel completely relaxed and energized in 30 minutes. It's amazing. So adults definitely need this. Modern-day adults, we have got to find some sanity. Everybody I know is just bitten off more than they can chew. Basically, if we take a music theory class at a modern university in the United States, on day one, well, then in the 13th century, Gregorian chant was there. I mean, instantly, we're in the 13th century. The Gregorian chant was around for over 1,000 years before Pope Gregory wrote it, had people write it down. And by writing it down, now you have to do what's written down. Now, I don't know, I'm not an expert in this, but apparently a lot of the chanting prior to that, more improvisational, thing called melisma, where they would chant alleluia, and on the final ah, they would go on, and this, you know, you kind of can hear the choirs at the Latin mass seeing this ah. They go on and on like that, very and improvisationally. And see, there was this process. There's a great book, if anybody is interested in this and can find the book, called Sounds of Wonder by Eddie Ensley. It's a Paulist Press book, and it's called Sounds of Wonder. And this is the most fascinating book I've ever read about music. He describes this ancient process called jubilation, where in the early Christian church, they chanted freely, without any agenda, without any words. This is not speaking in tongues. This is music. It's tone. Mystics did it. St. Francis talks about it. St. Teresa of Avila talks about it. All the popes, St. Augustine. It's just amazing. And these guys encouraged the parishioners to do it. The mystics did it out in their hermitages, in their monasteries and convents. And This is what was done then. And then things become more institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be more organized. Now, from the chanting came more than one chant. There's two lines going on. And this is called motet. You can get recordings where these motets are written out. Next thing you know, we have chords. So see, two melodies happened first, but then somebody comes along and says, now we're going to have the chords to be the underlying skeleton of the music. And of course, probably Bach is in the 1600. This, you know, the Age of Reason was born, and our culture in Europe just went off into this completely incredible unfoldment. And but you see, before chords, before the piano, there was just these melodic things, and they were simple. They were, the chanting was modal, meaning it just wasn't a major scale or a minor scale. There was all kinds of different combinations of notes. But then for some reason, I guess the piano, maybe, I'm not an expert on this, and I'm, the piano became kind of the bottom line of what music theory is, and chord progressions in the circle of fifths and all of these music theories. Now you go to a modern university in America, and it's, maybe it's almost like studying history, because you do study the Bach harmony theory. That's year one music theory. That's what you study. And
you say it's like teaching Shakespeare to people who haven't learned to read yet when you start and dive deep into all the structured music theory.
Yeah, it's about becoming
a performer.
It's very
complicated.
It's about being in the symphony. And if you're going to train, if your parents decide that you're 2 years old and you've got a talent in music, now we are going to put you in the fast track and you are going to be trained to be a virtuoso. There's the key there. Are we going to be virtuosos, or are we going to be just regular people who use music? And both of those are excellent. We want virtuosos.
And
I want
not
to
everybody
go
has to be one.
We can't assume that there's only one path and exclude the other, 9,999 so that the one out of 10,000 can be the great virtuoso.
Is the implication here that the Christian church at some point intentionally took out overtones or took out this inclusionary scale that anybody could pick up that is present in ancient music and ancient cultures, and so restricted it for some purpose?
I don't know that they did
gear
that intentionally. I don't know that we could say that. I do know that monasteries competed with each other to have incredible performance pieces that they could, you know, show off. And the minute competition comes into spiritual things like this, the intention
changes.
The intention is the key thing here. If the intention is virtuosity, great, go for it. But if the intention is meditation and devotion, egolessness, then one kind of has to follow the track of ego to some degree, and one is this complete surrendering. If I like that word surrender to describe what devotion is through music. You're surrendering yourself to the divine, and you can also surrender yourself through the process of music. But if you're going to be a virtuoso, you've got to be able to turn that switch on and off. And a person can learn to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be, it doesn't have to be one or the other.
But for those of us who aren't interested in being virtuosos but want to enjoy the full range of music and all that it has to offer, then the scales of the ancient music sounds... Can you sing a few notes to tell us what these different scales are? We're all familiar with the C scale and the various octaves. That's Western music. What are the other scales about?
The pentatonic scale, pent meaning five.
Okay.
You've got the octave, and the octave is just...
Eight.
One C to another C is physics. There's nothing really cultural about that. That's just how sound works, right?
Right.
But how you cut up the octave is on a piano or in China or in somewhere else, it can be a cultural decision. Now, there are interesting ways of cutting up the octave into five.
Tell us more about this, if you will, George. We need to take a quick break, and we'll come back with George Grant. You can visit his website at drumtalk.com. Look forward to his forthcoming book, also titled Drum Talk. And we'll come back to our chat with Paul and myself, Laura Lee. We're talking with George Grant of DrumTalk.com, telling us about his looking at music in a whole new way. And George, you were saying how the Sequence of notes is physics. How you group the notes is cultural.
Yes. We're talking about a pentatonic scale. Now, that's a big word. Pent means five. And the octave is really not cultural. That is something that is just the way it is. The great Greek seer Pythagoras, his dying words apparently on his deathbed were, "Study the monochord." It's just this long string that goes on this little platform that it's on, and you touch that thing, you pluck it, and it makes a tone. You put your finger exactly in the middle of it, and you pluck the other side, and you get the octaves. And all of these notes are just, everybody knows the octave. This, I'm going to play it. I hope you can hear this over the phone. There's a C, and here's the other one below it.
They're related.
You can hear it. They're considered the same note, C, but it's an octave above. Now, that is how physics works, that we hear that relationship. Now, we can cut this scale up into 12 parts, which is what the piano is. In Indian music, they divide the octave into 22 parts for the real ancient, esoteric, incredible scales. We basically, in the Western music, there's, I believe, 8 modes. We use 2 of them commonly, which we now call the major scale and the minor scale. In Indian music, North Indian music, there's, I think it's 72 major scales.
Major.
72. They commonly use only 10. But now, let's get down to an experience here. If this is our octave, okay, now I'm going to divide this into 5. I hope you can hear it. I'm going to get real bending over here. Can you guys hear that?
Barely.
It's okay. Right. Now that's a pentatonic scale. So now what is, here's the real juice of all this. Any of those notes combine with each other. So if I meditate, if I know that scale and I've learned it, I can improvise with that really nicely. You see how that works?
Yeah,
it's like I don't have to think about anything because if I know that melody, now, you know, if we want to fly, we have to grow some wings. It's not, this stuff isn't all fast food. Music takes a little bit of patience if you're going to get into the things like specific melodies. And I mean, anybody can get together and just make harmonies with each other and not even know or even care if it's pentatonic or Phrygian or Mixolydian. We don't have to know any of that stuff. But now, in terms of breaking up a scale into pentatonic, this is the real neat part about it, is that all those notes will combine and it'll set us free.
Right, because then you can play.
Then you have,
and you can soar,
a structure to work within. Now, we don't have to know a pentatonic scale to tone. And quite frankly, in my classes, we probably don't spend too much time doing this. What we would do is I might present a pattern to the group, and I would say, okay, the structure of our exercise is that there's only going to be 5 notes. And this is our safety contract with each other. You know that I'm going to give you 5 notes, and then the whole class will chant it back to me. So I might go, and the rhythm is just going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is just plain chant, really. There's no rhythm to this. Plain chant is what the monks did, the Gregorian. They still do this today in monasteries. They sing a very simple plain chant without a strict pulse. So I present 5 notes, and they copy it back to me, and then I present 5 more. And then they kind of loosely echo that back. And after doing this for 5 minutes, they have entrained with that. And they don't really have to know if it's a minor third and skip the fourth. You know what I mean? Learning by doing. There is a beauty in the choice of the notes that fit together nicely that the body likes. It's not about whether it's from this period of history or from this continent, but there is clearly, if we put our intuition on this, the beauty of tuned notes or tuned instruments, that it's not about being right or wrong or being some authority telling us. There is the common sense that these beautiful notes, when we learn them and we can resonate our bodies with them, that our cells and right. our hearts just completely love this. The ancient medieval thinkers did use the scale, as in what we'll call the piano, as a model for studying the universe and the music of the spheres and the relationship of the sun to the earth and to the planets. And they did use music as a model to study this kind of the inquiry into the cosmos. And these relationships and intervals, which means the distances between things.
From there, you jump right into mathematics, don't you?
Well, if you to study music theory in terms of chords in a music theory class in college, at a certain point of pressing your mind, all of a sudden you just see this mathematical beauty. I can't describe what that is because I'm not a piano player. I'm a percussionist who's basically self-trained, and I just struggled through music theory, but I did get through it. But there is incredible geometry mm-hmm. within all of this incredible development of harmony theory. Now, overtone chanting is a completely different matter.
Define overtones, would you?
Now, I have never done overtone chanting on the telephone, and I don't know what it's going to sound like to you guys, but I will attempt to do it, and you can tell me if this is just going to be completely crazy for you. It's basically one tone as a drone tone, meaning I'm not going to change the pitches. I'm not going to go, I'm going to sing, I'll sing one note, and then within it, you'll hear these higher whistling sounds will emerge from that thicker tone. Overtone means tone over. You can learn more by hearing this than talking about it.
That came across beautifully, George.
Okay, great.
How did you learn to do this? Is this what those famous Kyoto monks do?
Well, yes, there's monks in Asia that do this, and the Mongolian people have a tradition of this. The Tuvan people are very serious about this. There's an incredible movie. I recommend anybody find this. It's called
Genghis Blues.
Genghis Blues.
Isn't it wonderful? I love that movie.
It's an incredibly beautiful, sad story.
Yeah.
You know, but it's real and it's a documentary and you get to see this stuff. And wow, what a movie, huh?
What a movie.
And see, overtone singing, I learned pretty much the way that what's that man's name? Is it Pena? Paul Pena?
Yeah, yeah.
The hero in the movie,
a self-taught guy living in America,
learned it by listening on the radio.
Yeah,
and I pretty much did the same thing, and I was very eager. The first time I heard that, I had a friend of mine is this real quiet jazz musician, never gets excited, and his name is Ruben, and he says, "Hey George, I got something to check out. You know, it's real mellow." And okay, I'll be over in a minute, and we'll listen to it. And I was stunned. And my immediate, it was David Hykes, H-Y-K-E-S. He's got incredible recordings. And my instant reaction was, this must be done. You know, I love to listen to all kinds of music, but I have no real desire to study to become an opera singer and sing the, you know, Tristan and Isolde.
You're content just to enjoy someone else singing it for
That's
you.
Fine.
Okay.
I love to watch them do it. But this overtone chanting, I knew instantly I must do this. And I tried to figure out how to do it. And the more I studied about the knowledge of it, the less I think I knew. And then one day, I'm driving down the road after listening to some albums of this stuff, and I just started to do it.
Really?
And wow. It was just, I had somehow, I got in trouble as a child growing up for making noises, and I always loved to, and yeah. Later on in life, I get paid to make noises with theater troupes and sound studios and stuff, but I don't know, my voice is a way for me to fly a little, and I just imitated it, and what happened was that my throat really got kind of a Charlie horse in it. So I started to take singing lessons and learned the real science and techniques of throat body management, you know, so that you can learn how to use your vocal instrument. But then the overtone chanting was something that I just kind of started to do. And I developed my own little exercises, and the secret to being able to teach the way I do it is that I don't expect the students to aim for the overtoning. Mm-hmm. I don't even really sometimes tell them we're going to do overtoning. They just do the exercises, and the next thing you know, my goodness, their eyes are getting big, and they're going, what's that? And I go, now, and then maybe then I'll do it. Uh-huh. I'll make a quick little demonstration, okay. And then all of a sudden they realize that they've learned overtone chanting.
Wow. So you take some of the bar away so they don't feel like they have to jump over some huge hurdle.
The trick to overtone singing is really two things. Resonance of your voice and slowly changing vowel sounds. Oh. As you slip from oo to o, or from o to ah, or ah to eh, you will these with one pitch, not a melody, but one drone tone, the overtones just pop out. And this is why I get into debate with people about this. There's no controversy, there's no conflict, but people identify overtone singing with Tuva or with Mongolia or with, you know, monks. Or we have to name things. We're so left-brained that we can't leave anything alone. We have to name it. We have to name it. We have to classify it. Right. We have to sequence it. Right. This is all left-brain stuff. But really, if an airplane goes overhead or your refrigerator comes on or the fan in your car comes on, you will hear overtone because this is how sound works. This is why I say that we have to see that it's, yes, there's things that are cultural, but the way the overtone series works is not cultural at all. See what I'm saying?
See what exactly. You're saying, and we hear what you're saying, Jordan. Okay. I want another overtone demonstration.
I actually think that one of the ways to becoming spiritual is to keep our feet on the ground and try to have common sense and be natural and sometimes have humor. And in my courses, if we have to tell a joke to just keep people loose, but this is a very, very powerful meditation without there being religion to it.
Exactly.
Because the reason why is because if you're chanting and toning with that degree of being in the zone and you've kind of settled into it, the world around you just falls away. Mm-hmm. And you're left with what? You're left with, you might even forget that you're in your body, but you're left with yourself. And you're left with your connection with all these people that you're chanting with, and you merge into oneness. Now, this sounds lofty, but it works. Let me chant a sacred word for you.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, David Hikes, on his album called Harmonic Meetings, has a demonstration of this. It's basically the word Kyrie, which is, I believe, the first movement of a Latin mass. And Kyrie means great Lord. So if you are doing something like this with a group of people, you can contemplate the meaning. But the word Kyrie is resonant, very loaded with subtle vowel sound changes, and that's what we want for overtone singing, is vowels. So Kyrie, I will chant. At first, we just chant the word. We don't think about the goal of making overtones. We just chant the word, and the overtones pop out. And the right overtones, everybody that does that at the same pitch, the same sequence of overtones will pop out because of the physics, the universal laws here. But now you get used to what that is. It's like you know by an entrainment what the intervals are of those overtones, and then you can kind of improvise a little bit with it. Okay, this is Kyrie with a little bit of freedom, okay?
And it's amazing what the human voice can do. Wow.
I've done some performances. I remember a few tabla drum performances I did on stages, real high-end performances with packed audiences with these incredible performers from North India, and remembering the kind of these almost mystic experiences where, but yet there were still, I remember one where I was almost like watching myself, almost like it was so intense. I was like watching a movie. It was my hands were just moving, and I was watching myself. And I was thinking, if I never do anything again musically, it was all worth it to be able to experience this mystic, incredible entrainment with the artist I was with.
Yeah.
But I was still thinking, and I was still watching myself. When I do, just right now for you over the phone, if I do Kyrie, for that little bit of time, I'm not thinking. Do you know what I mean? I'm not really, I'm in my body, and I know that I'm George, and I'm on the phone talking with Laura and Paul, but yet there is a state of brain function completely different than that performance art on a stage.
Yeah.
I was riding a horse. I have serious asthma problems, and one of my big life goals is to be able to be on a horse for, like, you know, days at a time up somewhere in Montana or Wyoming. And I have serious allergies with dogs. I'm getting over it rapidly because of overtone chanting.
Wow.
I was on a horse. It was like the first, I was geared up for this for a couple years, and here I am on the horse up in Glacier National Park, and I could feel the asthma coming on, but I was just hanging on and just kind of keeping calm. And almost as a nervous reaction, I started to do overtone chanting with my mouth closed, and I could feel the asthma retreat, and it was amazing to me.
Yeah. Because you're reverberating the nasal passages and all of that, do you think that it just kind of shook that out of there?
My intuition at that moment was, I am short-circuiting something in my brain, which is basically correcting the improper, the asthma is a fault, the DNA
response.
Reaction. It's like having your fire alarm go off when there's no fire.
Oh.
So what I did was I said, well, we're going to turn that fire alarm off. But I didn't know how I did it consciously. I just know that it worked. And I know my asthma really well, and I know if I'm faking it or, you know, I mean, I don't fake it. My body tells me the truth, and I'm pretty calm about it. I can have a major asthma attack and not be emotionally stirred. I'm just physically affected. Mm-hmm. And this asthma stopped. It ceased.
In tracks.
And I was stunned. I mean, at the end of this thing, I had to go sit by a brook and just kind of, like, cry for a minute. It was so cool. And the lady, she was great. She gave me a lock of the horse's hair that I still carry with me.
Do you remember that moment? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. In the Kyrie, do you suppose that that's a sacred sound because by chanting it and overtoning it, it produces a particular effect in the brain that puts us more in tune with that God vibration? Or do you suppose that that word just has that physics, the subtle physics, like the Vedic seers were supposed to see? And then when we put it, run it through the body by chanting it, toning it, hearing it, even that, then it puts us close. Or is this a chicken and egg question, so that the human brain adapts to these sounds so that we're automatically stimulated in a certain way when we hear them, when we run them through the body?
I think both.
Okay,
I think that if you took a robot with a voice simulator or whatever it's called and had that robot sing Kyrie, that the overtones would come out. Now, the robot probably doesn't feel what we feel. When we're doing the chanting, the overtones are going to happen whether we believe in the sacredness of that word or not. And we are probably going to have a physiological reaction to making those overtones, whether we are a Catholic or even believe in God.
Right, because the physiological basis is there.
If we are making the toning, and we're doing the overtoning, but at the same time have an intention, if that word helps us contemplate, then it's just icing on the cake. I think both. I actually think both. Now, I think that somebody could chant Kyrie and not accurately do the overtones and have a higher meditation with it than somebody who can accurately chant the overtones but just thinks it's a game.
Oh, so part of it is it helps you focus your intent. I guess I was asking why those sounds. Why is Kyrie a sacred sound?
It's the vowel sounds, Laura.
That's what I'm asking.
U, O, A, E, these uh-huh. simple sounds. This is why if you go, and you it's interesting your question, because the word Alleluia is loaded with vowels. Uh-huh. Kyrie, when you hear a lot of these beautiful, rich Latin words, and you hear a well-trained choir sing a nice piece of literature, like, say, by Palestrina, the Italian composer of masses, vocal masses, choral masses. There's all these rich vowel sounds, and you will hear the overtones. So we can't say that overtones is just from Tuva or from Mongolia. There, if you know how to listen to them, you'll hear them within the beautiful Gregorian chant and the... Those parts of the chanting where they hang on to one pitch but keep singing a word.
Can you demonstrate in a Gregorian chant where the overtones come in?
If there's there's a part where they hang on to one note, but they're still singing, that's one to watch for them.
Ah.
Like, say if they're singing the word, and I don't know Latin, I don't know these songs, but if they're singing, I will now submit myself to the Lord, and I will surrender my ego to him or her. You see, you're saying something. Basically, there's one drone tone. You will hear, especially with those lush vowels that are in. And see, Laura, Latin is a sacred language, just like Sanskrit. And there's an intention, right? Mm-hmm. There's a reason for them using that as a language of the mass, and I don't know, but I think probably all of the above, all of it helps us open ourselves to, I think, ceremony, like a ceremonial attitude can really open us up.
I just wanted to also comment that, how scientists and researchers are finding that the human brain has a spot reserved just for experiences of God, that it's something innate and built into us. I would assume that that's true then for processing music, for using one's voice, for catching those overtones, for helping use that as a tuning fork to certain vibrations, to picking up on these subtle energies and therefore experiences. Comments, and then we're at the end of our hour. On that,
my
George.
Feeling on that is that the divine experience within us is probably not ever going to be totally measured. But those of us who have experienced it don't need to measure it. And almost everybody has had experience. If you love your parents, if you love your dog, how can that be measured? There is something, love, and love of something greater than yourself, and surrender of yourself to the greater good, all these things, I think it's natural. And I think it's right here with us all the time, except we're in this dense body, in a dense world of time and space, and music is one of the most magical things, and sound, we can say the word sound, it helps us to just become what we really are. And I think that our body is really like a wetsuit, and we're deep sea divers, and really we think we're the wetsuit, but we're not. We are the person inside the wetsuit, And when we use sound with intention and with inclusion and without judging other people and without ego to compete with each other, all of a sudden we find that, hey, I'm this person inside of the wetsuit. Isn't this interesting? And boy, I really love my wetsuit. Because of the wetsuit, I can do these other things.
I can navigate this ocean.
Does that make sense?
It certainly does, George. And thank you for all the insights and the fascinating demonstrations that you gave us. And we look forward to your forthcoming book.
Written by Dr. Bruce Saperstein at Utah State University. And we'll talk about that some other time.
Great. Sounds good. Thanks so much to Paul. And thank you, George Grant. And thank you for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com